So, when I went to Goenka retreat, it was, for me, I was like this, and when I came out of it, I was very concentrated, and it taught me something. And one of the things that I got out of it was, in fact, I was very changed, and it was profound, but was meditation on pain, which was, it was very interesting for me at the time. And I've been able to kind of carry that forward. And so over time, as I progressed in my meditation, I found that I do a lot of body sensation meditation. And I'm constantly kind of, I do yoga, so my body's changing as I meditate more. I'm in different postures and stuff like that. There's a lot of times there's this kind of, not overwhelming, but moderate to mild pain. And I find it's a really good edge. Very helpful.
It is. Did you hear? Could you all hear what she's saying? So Willow's describing being doing a Goenka style retreat, which focuses, which is very strong on concentration, and has learned over time from that retreat and from practicing how to work with, be with, and use the focus or the anchor of her body sensations, including when they're pain, chronic pain, sometimes stronger pain, and she finds it very useful. It's very similar as another anchor to the hearing, that, but it's more triggery, generally, because it's less impersonal when we have some pain. But we can then see that there's pain, so that's the thing, like there's a sound, and then the mind, typically, because of course that survival mode doesn't like it. It's adding, oh no, there's pain. And then it adds, what can I do to get rid of the pain? Or what if I can't get rid of the pain? Oh no, I'm going to be like this forever and I'm never going to go skiing again. And all of that proliferation, perpunctuating around the pain. And that's the tendency of the mind. But what we do as we practice is we discover we don't have to do that. We just feel that pain. And then we realize pain, what does pain mean anyway? It's sensation. Pain is a connotation of negativity and unpleasantness, whereas sensation is a sensation. And sometimes pain turns into sensation, and it's like interesting even. And so ways to practice, I'll just go on what you just said there, Willow, because it is really helpful. A way to practice several little things around pain, usually teach this in longer retreats, but is, of course, your attention goes. It's like sticky. It's loaded pain. You can't help it. Say it's your... Often it's my right knee, so I'll say it's my right knee. It's actually fine right now. But so there's your attention with your knee, because it's calling it there, charged. So rather than go right to the painful part, go to the edge of the pain. Many of you heard me say this many times, but it's really worth remembering. You just go towards the pain and see if you can explore the very outside edges of it. See if you can locate it and go to just outside where it's not painful. And then sort of creep your attention towards where is it beginning to be actually where it hurts, and then back off, or go on around like that. Because what you're doing, there's the pain, and there's your attention, but the typical response is, oh no, I don't like it. And your response now is, where is this, what is this, where's the edge of this? So your attitude isn't negative, it's just one of interest. And so you're now having a different relationship. So there's pain, which just is, and what with it, curious, allowing. Interested, RAINSLOWRAIN is what's happening instead of oh no, aversion, and then scheming to try and get rid of it. So you can do that for quite a few minutes, because you, especially if you place your attention more in what's comfortable, just before it gets to where it's uncomfortable, it's not going to trigger you the same way. And that gives you a different way of approaching it. Another way, and you can do that for a while and then switch away to something else, and then the next time it pulls you, you can differently, you can go to the pain area, go in there, and then if you can do this, ask yourself, so what exactly am I feeling here? What's it like? Is it, and you get to explore the actual characteristic of it, as if you're going to go and report to the doctor. So he says, oh, what's your symptoms? Describe them to me. And so you want to describe them clearly, or well, then you need to know them. Well, to know them, you have to allow them to be there, and you have to be interested in them, and you have to stay there and explore it. So your attitude is R-A-I-N. It is a diversion again, and you're not lost in a papuncha around it. You're simply being present and getting to know it. And that is a way of learning to be present and get to know anything, everything, whether it's pain, whether it's sounds, whether it's neurotic thoughts, whether it's, you know, how your heart's feeling, whether it's excitement, anything.
And I find this really helpful because I'm a therapist, and a lot of times I'm in these really intense situations, and I can really sit with people and be present.
Because you're able to stay with it in your body.
Yeah.
It's extremely useful. And when the Buddha taught mindfulness, sati patthana, the first foundation to be aware of the body. And some of the body is sensation, and just sometimes sensation gets intense enough that you can go into the what you would call pain. But once you start fiddling around with watching your mind with it, it can really shift. And oftentimes, and this isn't always the case if you're injured or something wrong, but oftentimes pain is just in the mind. You know, when your mind relaxes, suddenly that whole sensation disappears. It's extraordinary. However many times, hundreds and hundreds of times, people come to me and say, well, once I was able to relax and stay there and be with it, it all just kind of evaporated, or it just turned into something else, or it stopped being a problem. Well, it didn't stop being a problem. You stopped making it a problem by wishing it were different. You know, so it's all in the attitude. That's the thing. Okay, good. So I'm going to move on into what I want to be focusing on today, and which are it's called the universal characteristics. Three characteristics of every experience we have are in fact like this, but we don't know this, we don't recognize this, we don't see this, and so I'm wanting us to look at these today. It's kind of like so many of the ways the Buddha taught how things are, we can actually use that to see. Like, for instance, yesterday I was trying to have you be aware of catching onto and letting go, how the mind catches onto and letting go. It's just a way of looking at the mind. And so it's like a lens. You pick up, like picking up, where are my glasses? You pick up your glasses and you look through them, and these glasses are magnifying glasses, they're reading glasses, so I can now see things that I couldn't see more clearly because they're magnifying. Sometimes they're sunglasses, and so now you can see because they're darker shading. Sometimes they're rose-colored glasses, and then you see really beautiful pink, beautiful soft, fuzzy things, and so on. Magic glasses. It's like they're lenses to help you see something through a different, slightly different perspective. And all the teachings the Buddha has, and the way he taught, he all these different things in terms of the hindrances. Look at things in terms of clinging and letting go. So now I want you to look at things in terms of the three characteristics. So they're a lens. And I like that whole image. I sort of pick up. I have my Dharma lunette. And so I have one, they actually, opera lunette from the 18th century for some reason, I don't know. And I have, this is all in my mind. And I have a, you know, one handle stick, and then they have however many little lenses attached to that stick. Mm-hmm. So if it's a hindrances, there are five of them, and I go, is this wanting? Is this aversion? Is this restlessness? And I look to see my terms of these Dharma teachings. I think that's a clever way, anyway, it's just my. So today I want us to look in terms of these three characteristics, which are always happening, but we mostly don't notice. And they are that everything is changing. And they are, therefore, if everything is changing, then nothing is available to be relied upon for very long. And so it's not trustworthy, not secure. So it's not going to satisfy our wants and needs because it's impossible. And also because it's always changing, it isn't just changing. It's being changed by forces on it. And so all kinds of things, conditions around are allowing things to be as they are, making things as they are, and then the conditions change because everything changes. And then the thing, whatever it may be, your mood, an idea, an opinion, something solid in the material world, is going to change too. And so the thing that we thought was something isn't really that something because it's about to be something else. And so it's not the idea of separate self. The idea of something being a separate, discrete entity, including yourself, isn't in fact true. And we, you know, the way we perceive with a little mind is that things are stable and we want them to be stable and we're endlessly trying to stabilize everything. We also want it to be the way we want it to be, and then provide us with security and satisfaction, and we want the pleasant things to stick around so we'll be happy, try to fix and find happiness. And we think that the thing that we're wanting to stabilize, for example, is something that will stay, that will then make me happy. All of that is actually not seeing clearly. As we meditate, then we don't just connect our attention to a particular object as an anchor. We don't just learn how to relax and stabilize this view, which is what we learn as we meditate. And those moments of being on the edge of the washing machine get longer and longer. What we then see, because we have these inner, we're looking, the Vipassana is looking, we're present. We're not just present, sort of drifting asleep, we're present and aware. And this awareness then can perceive. What we start to see is more truly and deeply what's really going on, not just the quick images which only the jumpy mind gets to think it's seeing. We start seeing more deeply, start seeing more profoundly, and we start seeing much more realistically. And so we do start to see, for instance, these characteristics. We see other things, but we see these characteristics. This is a it's a huge part of the teachings of the Buddha, and it's hugely significant because if we see in terms of these three, our whole relationship to the way things are changes, our whole relationship to how we're living changes. Changes from wanting to have and wanting to get rid of to allowing and befriending and being much more realistic and balanced about that things are pleasant, things are unpleasant, and things are in between and boring. And that's the way it is. And we're not in argument with it. You don't just see yourself thrashing around as you know what can't be your name. In the middle at the back there, you were speaking about the washing machine last night, the thrashing. What's your name?
Helena?
Helena. Helene.
Helene.
Helene. Helene. Helene. Helene. Names are ridiculous, but anyway. Helene can't be named. Helene was saying about the washing machine. No, it completely made me lose my whole train of thought here. When we're in the washing machine, we're actually being busy. We're in some form of conflict. We're against what's happening. That's why we're thrashing. That's why it's exhausting. We're wanting what isn't here to come. Or we're wanting what's leaving to not leave, or we're wanting to get rid of what's here, or we're wanting to avoid what might. So we're sort of against it all the time. In that the little EA, this part of us, is in always ready for trouble and trying to sort out situations. It isn't surrendered. It isn't like, oh, this is what's happening. My knee is feeling that intense tingling again. It's like, oh no, I've got to do it. No. And so there's a constant conflict going on. We don't see that. We don't realize we're doing that. Well, until we see that we're doing that, how can we stop doing it? We have to be able to recognize that's what's going on. But there's this messing around with everything, always trying to make it slightly different, which is a non-accepting. And so when we can see that things are always shifting, and our relationship to them isn't so clinging and isn't so desperately trying to fix them, or the doing of that is ridiculous when we said it's going to shift and change anyway. We are released from that neurotic behavior. Right? So when we actually see what's really going on, we see how inappropriate our behavior is. But if we don't really see what's really going on, our behavior seems perfectly rational. And it's also what everyone else's behavior is like, and it's also how we've succeeded so well in surviving for millions of years. So it's not that bad. But deeply, it's irrational. So this is about depth. Spiritual life is sort of beyond just the regular survival mode life. And so we're seeing a whole other dimension. And then our survival mode life seems ludicrous and is exhausting. Okay, so I'm going to talk a little bit more about this whole topic. There is so much said about the Nietzsche. Anybody know the chant? Anicca, sankhara, upadavaya, dhamminam, upakitua, nerujanti, tesang, upasamo, sukham. All things To understand this deeply brings the greatest form of happiness, which is peace. It's one of the most well-repeated suttas, teachings of the Buddha all through the lands that people practice this. So I'm going to read a bunch of quotes from all over the place about change, to kind of like, and some of mine. We cannot see change. We don't want to see change, and we don't see change. We jump to something which is with our attention, and then we jump with our attention to something else which is, and then the next thing which is. Because we don't stay, we don't first thing turning into something else. So we've left it before it changed, and our mind is quicker and on to the next thing, so we don't get to see this. But when you stay with your attention on something, it's inevitable to show. So look at, take anything. Tell me something. Anybody tell me a thing. Name something. I don't care what it is.
The sun.
The sun. Oh my God.
Water bottle.
I'm going to go to water bottle. It's a little simpler. I'm going to take this water bottle. Okay. So this is apparently a water bottle. It's actually, I think it's steel. Some kind of metal, and inside it is liquid, and it's got a plastic top. This plastic top, I'll start with, is actually was once oil in the ground, and it didn't begin as oil. It began as trickling, and then they rotted down over millions of years, and there was heat applied and pressure, and then it got sludgy and turned into oil, and got sucked up and put in a ship, and then into some kind of refinery process, and turned into plastic, and then molded into a shape, and then called top. Bottle top, which will eventually apparently break down into minute little tiny crumbs of plastic and be eaten by fishes. This is metal. I don't know how that happened, but it's part of the rocks, and in the rocks is minerals, and then through the process of mining and then heating and then purifying and then merging together and heating and then cooling into molded shapes, you get shapes. And this was a hollow shape with an opening at one end, which humans have created for thousands of years to put things in. Very clever. It's just metal in a shape, but we call it bottle. And because this one is designed for us to drink water, and we could put anything in it. It could be a sand bottle, but because we put them in certain racks at certain places in certain shops, we call them water bottles, and we put water in. And water. Water is all kinds of things. It's just liquid, H2O. It's liquid, and liquid contains many, many things and comes from many things. And then you can add all kinds of things to water. Water is just a word for the liquid element, which has so many forms. It can, when it's hotter, become steam, becomes cloud, it's ocean because it has salt in it, it's your own intracellular fluid with the same amount of salt as an ocean, urine, sweat, apple juice, inside fruit, especially carrot juice. It's water with some of the bits of the carrot in it, flavoring water. But it's not one thing, it's not a discrete thing, it's part of everything else in changing around. Okay, name something else. You got the idea. Name something else. Somebody, anything.
Red.
Hmm?
Red.
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 Red. Oh, God. Red. Red, the most basic thing. What's in bread? So many things are in bread. Fields full of grains are in bread. Sunshine. Water, of course, too. Yeast from fermented juices. It's extraordinary. Salt from the ground. To put in oil from pressed nuts. All the ingredients are put together into a thing that you give it one name, but it's made up of all these many other things. And the other thing about it, something like bread, even more organic, it's not going to stay bread for very long. How long does bread last? And then what does it become? Usually it gets eaten, so it becomes energy inside your body and eventually feces and eventually goes, I don't know where, into the ground or the ocean. But if you didn't eat it, it would just become moldy and then it would become rotten stuff which would become soil, wouldn't it? A compost. Compost is soil, but actually compost is all kinds of other vegetable matter, and you put them all together and then they turn into something else, turn into soil. And then soil is food for things to grow out of. Nothing is fixed. Soil isn't soil for very long. It's, you know, it was compost and it will be nutrients and it'll be covered with leaves and it's always changing. Everything is like this. Everything is part of something else changing, part of this unfolding thing. Whatever you want to name, turn into something else. So your car is going to turn into something else. It's going to turn into some compacted metal in a landfill. And it isn't a car anyway in the first place. What it is, I don't know, how many pounds of metal and 5 wheels of rubber that came from the ground and a bunch of miles of electric cable and I don't know how many tons of screws and stuff like that. All in a big pile that they've assembled in a certain fashion and called BMW. It's just a name for accumulation of a bunch of pieces, a function which we can get in and move around. It's an amazing thing. All the things you own will eventually probably be landfill. I mean, you know, if they're really well made and somebody really likes them and they've got some sort of inherent beauty or somebody really protects them, they'll become an antique before they get into the landfill. But I have a few of those family heirlooms. But on the whole, quicker than that, it'll be trash somehow. Having gone through various little incarnations, everything, clothes, cloth, you can watch cloth disintegrate. We don't think of it. We think of, oh, this is great, this new piece of clothing, but it's just going to be the Sally Ann in no time. Mountains crumble to the sea. This happens very rapidly inside our experience, of course, with our moods and our ideas, even our beliefs in things, they change. You know, you have somebody convince you of something, the opposite sometimes. And there's our bodies, oh my God, wrinkles come. Yes, hair goes, hearing goes, sight gets dim, all that. Feet get funky. I'm amazed at my feet these days. 66-year-old feet, I look like 36-year-old feet. Computers. Designed to have to be thrown out in 3 or 4 years. Bertrand, a wave in the sea persists for a longer or shorter time. The waves that I see dashing themselves to pieces on the Cornish coast may have come all the way from Brazil, but that doesn't mean that a thing has travelled across the Atlantic. It means only that a certain process of change has travelled. Bertrand Russell again. We found that matter in modern times has lost its solidity and substantiality. It's become a mere ghost haunting the scenes of its former splendour. The notion of matter in modern physics has become absorbed into the notion of energy. Even Heraclitus from Greece in all those years ago said there is no static being, no unchanging substratum. Change, movement is lord of the universe. Everything is in a state of becoming, a continual flux. And I've got all kinds of quotes from different wise monks and the Buddha. Whatever is, will be, was. Reality is never static, but is dynamic throughout. It's a common sight in Buddhist lands to see the devotees offer flowers and light oil lamps before a Buddha image. They're not praying to the Buddha or to any supernatural being. The flowers that fade and the flames that die down speak to them of the impermanence of all conditioned things. Only things appear solid, but they change, but it's so rapid that they give the illusion of solidity. And we can really get that with sounds. When your mind gets quiet, you hear a sound, and it seems to be an ongoing sound. And when you can be really perceptive, you can really hear the separate sound waves creating what apparently is earth sound. And we know, of course, it can be measured. You've heard people's voices slowed down mechanically to the point that they actually be separated out again. You can hear the separate pieces of it. So it's not just an idea, we can experience this. The people of the world today mark the changing nature of life. Although they see it, they don't keep it in mind and act with dispassionate discernment. Though change again and again speaks to them and makes them unhappy, they do their mad career of whirling around the wheel of existence that are twisted and torn between the spokes of agony. I don't know who this is, some religious teacher, some Buddhist monk. They cherish the belief that it's possible to discover a way of happiness in this very change, to find a center of security in this circle of impermanence. They imagine that although the world is uncertain, they can make it certain and give it a solid basis. And so the unrelenting struggle for worldly improvement goes on with persevering effort and futile enthusiasm. Of course, that's not them, it's us, right?